Well, if you would go and open your Bibles up to Luke chapter 14, I know some of you might be thinking, but we didn't finish 13. I didn't hear an outcry, but I know that's what you were thinking. We're going to come back to chapter 13 on Easter Sunday. After we're going to look the next 2 weeks, Dan is going to preach next week. I'm going to preach the week after. And we're going to look at this topic that we've been talking a bit about with you on family discipleship and explain a bit more what that means and explain about what that looks like from the scriptures. And so we'll look at Luke 14 this morning, 1 through 24. We'll come back to Luke 13 on Easter Sunday. But for today, Luke 14, verses 1 through 24. Several weeks ago, we started what we call the family table. It's in your bulletin. You see it on the left side of the bulletin, I think it is, with three questions to hopefully have you take home with you. And ask your family after the sermon, or ask whoever it might be that you're having lunch with after church. And this is meant to be ways for which you might be able to connect further with what has been proclaimed, what has been seen, what has been preached to you, and apply that even more so to your lives. Now, the reason why we started this was to help not just parents engage with their children. Yes, that is one way. We have encouraged children to be in the service with us, so therefore we ought to look to intentionally engage them even afterwards. But even more so, whoever it is perhaps you're having lunch with, whoever it is that you're perhaps sitting with maybe at some point during the day who has been with you in service, to allow you all to connect on a bit of a deeper level with the Word of God. And it's called, we said, the family table, because we imagine you perhaps sitting around a table with family and friends, talking and discussing, interacting and conversing about the truth that you've just heard from God's word. As a culture, if you think about this, we've gotten a little bit out of the habit of gathering around the table, whether it be perhaps maybe you remember as a kid, Sunday lunch with your whole family or dinner together, maybe in the evening. More often than not, families are going every which way and just don't eat together as much as they used to. Or now what is more common is to have a family where every member perhaps has a device in their hand and they're no longer engaged with one another, but instead engaged with a game or virtually with other people rather than the person who's sitting right across from them. Yet none of this takes away from what the dinner table has meant, not just historically, but even biblically. Consider historically, for example, the home of Martin Luther. Martin Luther, the Protestant reformer, essentially helped launch the Reformation back in the 16th century. A very bold and brilliant man, but at the same time, very down to earth with everybody he interacted with. Well, he was known for what later became called his table talks. For you see, his home became sort of a revolving door where he'd have all sorts of people who would come in during the evening, religious leaders, pastors, students, and they'd often come and they would just sit at his dining room table with him and eat and converse and talk. And his conversations with them were very colorful, very interesting and convicting perhaps and encouraging, with some of those conversations even being recorded and later published. And if you ever had a chance to read them, you'll quickly see how significant this family table time was in the lives of those who stopped in. So consider, for example, a quote from that conversation that he had one night around his family table. He said this around his table: "We have neglected the pure and clean word. We have gone from the clear fountain to a foul puddle and drunk its filthy water, which is taught us and taught to us by friars and monks." Remember, Luther was part of the break from the Catholic Church and starting the Protestant Reformation. And so often this was a time of teaching and a time of conversing and answering questions and talking devotionally with those who were with him as he led the movement back to God. You can imagine how impactful, but also perhaps how dangerous those conversations would have been. At the same time, though, it's interesting to consider that the truth of redemption throughout scripture is often revolved around a meal of sorts. So for instance, you think back to the fall of humanity with Adam and Eve disobeying God. How do they disobey God? They ate of something that he asked them not to. He commanded them not to. Later, you look at the covenant with Abraham, and it was confirmed by what? By eating a meal in Genesis 18. And you imagine Abraham there with the Lord. Or you think of the Israelites and their plight in Egypt and their escape from Egypt. What did the Lord command them to do? He gave them the Passover. The Passover was what? It was a meal of which they celebrated to remember God's deliverance of them. Yet when we come to the Gospels, we see that the table where Jesus is gathered with others for meals is sometimes hijacked. You might think of Luke chapter 11, when in verse 37, Jesus is asked to dine with a Pharisee. And the Pharisee, he calls Jesus out for not washing his hands. Well, that dinner, it quickly becomes bad as Jesus uses that moment to go after their unclean hearts. The unclean hearts of the ruling elite who are sitting there around the table with him. And now as we come to Luke 14, we see a very similar situation. Jesus is again, he's gathered around a table, but this time he's gathered around this table on the Sabbath. If you remember from last week, Jesus had gotten into it with a synagogue ruler over healing a woman who had what was called a disabling spirit. In other words, she was bent over and could not straighten up. But now the perfect storm comes as the religious leaders look to catch him in some sort of law breaking over a dinner on the Sabbath. So as we'll look this morning, we'll look at what we might call the hijacked table, verses 1 through 24 of Luke chapter 14. Look with me as we begin in verse 1. One Sabbath, when he, Jesus, went to dine at the house of a ruler of the Pharisees, they were watching him carefully. And behold, there was a man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus responded to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. Then he took him and healed him and sent him away. And he said to them, "Which of you, having a son or an ox that has fallen into a well on a Sabbath day, will not immediately pull him out?" And they could not reply to these things. Verse 7. Now he told a parable to those who were invited when he noticed how they chose the places of honor, saying to them, "When you are invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in a place of honor, lest someone more distinguished than you be invited by him. And he who invited you both will come and say to you, 'Give your place to this person.' And then you will begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you are invited, go and sit in the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he may say to you, 'Friend, move up higher.' Then you will be honored in the presence of all who sit at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." He said also to the man who invited him, "When you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed because you cannot repay you. They cannot repay you. For you will be repaid at the resurrection of the just." When one of those who reclined at the table with him heard these things, he said to him, "Blessed is everyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of God." But he said to him, "A man once gave a great banquet and invited many. And at the time for the banquet, he sent his servant to say to those who had been invited, 'Come, for everything is now ready.' But they all alike began to make excuses. The first one said to him, 'I bought a field. I must go and see it. Please have me excused.' And another one said, 'I bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I go to examine them. Please have me excused.' And another said, 'I have married a wife, therefore I cannot come.' So the servant came and reported these things to his master. Then the master of the house became angry and said to his servant, 'Go out quickly to the streets and the lanes of the city and bring in the poor and the crippled, the blind and the lame.' And the servant said, 'Sir, what you have commanded has been done, and there's still room.' And the master said to the servant, 'Go out to the highways and the hedges and compel people to come, that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of those men who were invited shall taste of my banquet.'" All right, so let's get this table scene clear here for just a second. Jesus, he's just been invited to the house of a very prominent man. In fact, verse 1 here says that he is the ruler of the Pharisees. So in other words, he is sort of what we might call a supreme leader, what we might call the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin was the Jewish court at that time. So this is no shabby dinner. Yet, look who Jesus encounters when he gets to dinner. Perhaps you can set the scene here. He's about to walk in, and maybe someone is standing outside or sitting outside of the door to the house that he's about to walk in. Verse 2, it's a man with what is called dropsy. Now, dropsy is a condition also known as edema, which is where fluid gets trapped inside body tissue and you begin to swell and look overly bloated in your legs and feet and in your arms. Add to this, dropsy was known as a condition that would make you very thirsty as well. So imagine being already swollen and wanting to drink a lot of water. The problem was with this condition is that you would never quench your thirst. So you would continue to drink and drink and drink and drink, which would worsen the condition, causing even more swelling. I don't think it was any surprise to Jesus that this man just, quote, happened to be there out front of this house. In all likelihood, it's a setup, which is sad if you think about this, the Pharisees bringing in a man with a genuine condition and placing him right in front of the house on the Sabbath to see what Jesus might do. Well, this dinner from the very beginning had already been hijacked. For if the ruler of the Pharisees, the supreme judge of the Sanhedrin, can catch Jesus doing something labeled as unlawful, since remember, this dinner again was on the Sabbath, well, then they have him. He's a fraud. That's why they're carefully watching him, as we see here in verses 1 and 2. They want to see, is he going to heal on the Sabbath, or will he follow their twisting of the law? Well, if you remember from last week, the Pharisees, they put together this code of sorts as to how they will act on the Sabbath. So they would say things like, you can untie your ox and lead him to water, but you can't heal someone, for that is labeled as unnecessary work. Jesus knows what's going on here. Yet the Pharisees, who in some sense are playing checkers, don't realize who it is they're trying to trap. It's the man who comes back playing chess with them instead. And so Jesus here in verse 3, he springs a question on them in the midst of their supposed trap. And he says, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Jesus here, a master at how he asks this question too. For he didn't say, is it against tradition if I heal on the Sabbath? But no, instead, he implies, is it a violation of the law of Moses to heal on the Sabbath? Jesus had reversed this hijacked table. Because now those seeking to trip Jesus up, were caught in their own trap. And we know this because of their response. Look at the response, verse 4. They don't respond. They're silent. Why? Because of what Jesus would say to them in verse 5. Which of you, having a son or an ox that has fallen into a well on a Sabbath day, will not immediately pull him out? In essence, Jesus just said, you make provision for your animals, but you get all in a bind if I make a provision for a person. Where the Pharisees spoke up here in verse 4 instead of remaining silent, they'd have to admit to Jesus and to all of those around them that they actually valued their ox more than they did a person. But there's more than just a question posed to these Pharisees at this hijacked dinner. No, Jesus now moves into some teaching, and he tells them a parable that moves beyond this gotcha moment, and he goes straight for their heart. And as he does so, Jesus first tells his listeners to pursue humility. Chuck Colson, perhaps you know that name, perhaps you've read something by him in the past. He was on the special counsel for President Nixon back in the late 60s, early 70s. Actually went to prison as being one of the main players in the Watergate scandal. Well, before going to prison, he converts to Christianity, which leads him to accept his fate without a flight. He goes into the courtroom, pleads guilty, and willingly accepts the consequence for what he did. Beside that point, though, he tells about his life as an aide to the president, describing the way Washington, D.C. is, which was literally hobbled by status and rank and those who were seeking and pursuing more and more power. He goes on and he says that he and several other aides would often travel on Air Force One with the president. And Colson recalled this story, and he said, I can remember that one of the associates of the president, in seeking so much power position, would often take out a ruler and measure the distance between the president's chair and the chairs of those who would sit next to him so that no one would be closer to the president than him. For to this man, everything was about position and was about power. And if you're going to be somebody, you can't let anybody else beat you out. There's a certain principle here that Jesus is trying to communicate with a group of teachers and Pharisees he's having dinner with. For as he is sitting at this hijacked dinner, the one thing that he notices among many, I'm sure, is that there are people at this dinner who seem to want to have places of honor or seats of honor that were not necessarily reserved for them. They want the closest position. They want people to see how revered they ought to be. You see, typically, the way that a party went in that time was that you would have this U-shaped table in the sitting in the middle of the room, this table, and the guest of honor or the host would sit right in the center, and the guest of honor, in honor of rank or in order of rank, would sit out further, leading to who would be the least in that honor. And so you have the most honored guest, of course, speaking next to perhaps the high official or the one who is the host. It might be a close friend. It might be the speaker of the day, whoever it is. And then going out further from there to the least honorable position, which would be at the very end of the table. Be sort of like a wedding where you have tables with people's names assigned to them. In some cases, you might have the wedding party seated at a table, which might be up front. Perhaps on the stage, you'd have the bride and the groom in the middle, going out from them to the maid of honor, best man, going out from there to the rest of the bridal party. To go and to take a spot right next to the groom or right next to the bride, well, that could potentially lead to an embarrassing situation if you're not part of the bridal party. Not only would that show a lack of awareness, but that might also show a lack or a level of arrogance. Now, why? Here's why that situation might be embarrassing, not only to the host, but also to the guest as well. If you sit in a seat that's not yours, and especially that seat that you sit in is for the honored guest, then what's going to happen? You're going to be asked to move. And if you are a person who thinks very highly of themselves, which at times we have to admit can be any one of us, then having to move seats, especially after having sat down in front of a crowd with a dinner plate and a drink in hand, that could be a very embarrassing situation. But it gets worse. In the case of this dinner party that Jesus is describing, he says that not only will the person who arrogantly sat in the seat of honor be asked to move, but he will have to move not just one seat down, but he's going to have to move all the way down to the lowest seat available. Now, the reason for this could be many, but likely what may be happening is that the person who sat in the wrong seat is not going to be able to ask another guest to stand up and move so that he could sit in the next honored seat. No, these guests are already seated. He's going to have to go down to the least honorable position. In fact, for this humiliated person who's just been asked to remove himself from the seat, the wise thing to do would just be simply to go to the lowest seat available. Because how humiliating would it be to have to switch seats again? Now, the point that Jesus is making here in verses 7 through 11 here is that we ought to pursue humility. But what happens to this man asked to remove himself is not humility occurring, but no, is in fact what we might call humiliation occurring. You see, there's a difference between those two words. Humiliation does not always result in a humble attitude. Instead, what humiliation reveals is an arrogant attitude. And just because someone was humiliated does not mean that they are now going to show humility. I'm sure we can all think of people, maybe even ourselves, at some point in time, who have been humiliated, but that did not necessarily turn into humility. Because humiliation doesn't necessarily equal humility. True humility only comes when we begin to see ourselves for who we really are in light of who God really is in front of us. You think about that. That's how true humility comes. If you want to grow in humility, recognize who you are for who you are as a sinner. Recognize who God is for who he is as a holy and righteous creator. That will then begin to breed humility in your heart. If you're not a Christian here this morning, that is the first necessary step for you to take. To have a proper view of your sin for who you are and to proper view of God and who he is in his holiness and righteousness. And that should result in the realization that you are in desperate need of Jesus Christ. Many of the world will think that God will simply accept them for who they are, that perhaps their few good deeds will cut it before a perfect and righteous God. But to think that because of who you are, that God will overlook all of your sin is not only misguided, but it's in fact very arrogant. Instead, what you need is to see Jesus Christ as the one who came in the ultimate display of humility as the only perfect man to ever live on this earth and to obey God, but yet who died in our place so that we might be saved. So again, if you're not a Christian here this morning, humble yourself today and come to Christ. And once you become a Christian, the process of growth, it takes you through stages of awareness. Think about that. You begin to become more and more aware of your sin, more and more aware of your need for Jesus Christ. You see, when you first become a Christian, you may only be aware that you need someone to save you, and that's great. That's a good place to start. But as you grow, you begin to see that God directs your life and he shapes your decisions and he cares for you through your difficulties. And then you move to become more and more humble before God as you grow to realize that you could not live your life without him. But growth and humility also makes you more aware of others. You begin to see people as created by the same God that you were and that you are in his image. You begin to see people around you that they have needs and they have thoughts and they are valuable and that this world is about more than just you. Growth with God always means growth before others. Meaning that if you're growing then in godliness and your relationship with the Lord, you don't become more prideful. You don't look more selfish. You don't become less loving to those around you. No, you become more aware of yourself, your heart, and of others. In fact, how you treat others is often an indicator of what you think about God. And how you treat others is often an indicator of your relationship with the Lord. That's the underlying point that Jesus is making here with these teachers. There's a bigger picture at play here, Jesus is saying to them. Yes, you're trying to trap me and use this dinner for places of honor, but examine your own heart here. Pursue humility. Why not think more humbly about yourselves as you should and let others move higher? For those who humble themselves will be exalted. Well, secondly, look to the resurrection. So after Jesus closed this first parable in verses 7 through 11, which mainly dealt with the guests at this hijacked dinner party, he adds another point in verses 12 through 15, and now he's dealing with the host of this hijacked dinner party. So he says to him, hey, when you throw a party, don't just simply invite people who are going to invite you back. Don't have people over for the purpose of serving yourself. Don't simply invite your friends or your family or your rich neighbors, but instead look outward, look beyond what earthly advantage you may get from them and invite those who have nothing at all to offer you. Back in that time, it was customary to repay anyone who did you any sort of favor. And even now, it's still nice. We know this. It's common courtesy to recognize people who do something for you. At times, we even have this urge to want to repay them or to do something back for them, or at least to write them a note that says, thank you for doing that for me. But back then, it was even more so. It was expected that you would repay a favor with a favor. Perhaps you can understand this as you think about Christmas time. There are certain people you know that you need to get a gift for because you know they're getting you a gift. But perhaps you don't know who's going to give you the gift until they actually give it to you. And then once you get that gift, you might say something like, oh, you shouldn't have done that. But then you know you have this short window by which you then might need to get them a gift in return. The same would be true with a dinner as Jesus talks about here. Someone invites you over to dinner. Then you immediately plan when you're going to have them over for dinner. But Jesus, he counters that thought here and he builds on the theme of humility. And he says, don't live your life that way. Instead, don't look to what you can receive, but instead look to what you can give. Serve the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind. Serve those in need and those who will provide you with absolutely nothing in return. Why? Because in the end, the reward you ought to be looking to shouldn't be a simple repayment on this earth, but to an eternal reward in heaven. A repayment at the resurrection. a well done, good and faithful servant, an eternity of joy beyond what anyone in this world could repay you or offer to you in return. Now, that call is not simply for some extreme Christian. That's a call for all of us. It's a call to invest in others without expecting return. It's a call to forsake yourself, to look beyond this world. It's a call to perhaps serve in the church or to serve those around you, giving up yourself, not looking for some sort of earthly accolade or repayment, but doing so merely looking towards the resurrection and the glory of God. For there is a joy in caring for those and being with those who will never be able to give you anything in return. And that joy comes in the form of the eye of God looking down in pleasure upon you. That is why we as a church do many things that we do, whether it be giving away clothes or dresses or hosting kids for a week during the summer vacation Bible school. And in many ways, you think about this, this is completely contrary to what many church growth experts will tell you to do. Many church growth experts will tell you to do things where you might receive a return and receive people into your midst. And that's ultimately a desire of ours, that through serving, we might see people come to know Christ and join with us in fellowship. But ultimately, that's not the only reason why we serve people. We serve people out of a desire to exalt Christ, but to receive our reward, not here on this earth, or a repayment of what they might do for us, but ultimately looking towards the resurrection. That's why we feed people who come to us and look for help. That's why we might sit and listen to the story of a man or woman who doesn't know where to turn next. Our hope, again, is that we might proclaim Christ to them, see them trust in him, or even come to our church. But the truth is, we may never see those people ever again, meaning that we may never see any sort of result, or in the words of this parable, repayment in this life. But in the life to come, at the resurrection, we know that there will be a reward greater than what we might have ever been able to expect in this life. And we've got to keep that in the forefront of our minds. Because if we don't, then we will eventually give up and say that it's not worth it anymore. We must be like Jesus, who did not focus on what was about to occur, but as instead, as Hebrews 12:2 says, endured the cross, despised the shame, because he knew that in the end, he would sit down at the right hand of God. That's our hope. That is our mindset, our motivation, and the way that we ought to live as Christians. And it'll take nothing less than humility in this life so that we might be exalted in the next. Well, then lastly, we see that we must accept the invitation. After having spoken to these guests at the hijacked dinner table and now to the host, Jesus moves into this second parable, which speaks to those who were invited or to those who responded to the invitation. Here you have a man who's about to throw a dinner party. He's probably planned this dinner party for months. He has all his friends and family members that he wants to invite. And as the day approaches, he learns that none of them are going to show up. Back in those days, it would have been customary to send out two announcements for a dinner party. The first one was usually an invitation to come to a banquet or to a dinner. But at the time of this event, it would probably only be about an estimate as to when this dinner might take place. It would have been difficult always to set an exact time, especially when people did not own watches or when banquets would have taken a lot of preparation and people needed to travel in. So then typically you would send out an invitation for all those to receive the invitation. And then you would send out an announcement closer to announce the actual time in which this dinner would take place. And so when Jesus explains in this parable is that there's a man, he's hosting a party, and he's already received a favorable response from many people who are coming to this party. But the last minute, when he sends the announcements back out to these people, gives further definition to what this party will look like, reminds them of the day and the time of which they need to be there, those who've already agreed to this party in the first place, to let them know the banquet is ready, all of them decline to come. And you can imagine you planning perhaps a Thanksgiving meal, talking about it months ahead of time with your family members, planning for it, having all the food ready, and then calling the day before and say, hey, we're going to eat at 2:00. And then every single person saying, we can't come. Well, in real life, that would likely be very hypothetical, if not impossible. To have a party where you invite 50 people and all of them who want to come later than at the last minute decline to come. But remember, this is a parable, not a real life situation. This is used to teach us the central truth about God and his kingdom here. All those invited, they decline at the last minute. The most common event that connects itself to what Jesus is talking about here is probably a wedding. At a wedding, invitations are sent out, 4 to 6 weeks in advance, perhaps? And there are usually an RSVP card that goes with it that needs to be filled out. Many of them check yes or no as to whether or not they're going to attend. If there's a reception, they might choose, I'll take the chicken or I'll take the steak or whatever it is that you might be serving. Now, to those who've replied and marked what meal they would like, to then not attend is a very frustrating thing. But to have everyone who agreed to come back out of the last minute, well, that could be devastating. What do you do with all that food, all that preparation? Who's going to celebrate the occasion of which you invited people to in the first place? Now, what makes this worse is the excuses that are offered up. Do you catch them when we read them? They're not emergency issues that sound legitimate as to why someone would miss a previously agreed upon occasion. Quite frankly, they're lame excuses. And they're lame excuses that not only are lame to the person offering them, but they're not respectful of the person they give it to. The first one, I bought a piece of land. I need to go look at it. Well, likely if you buy land, you think about even in our own time, but that would have been especially prominent in that time too. If you're going to buy land, what do you do before you buy that land? You go out and see it, right? This man, he claims, he goes, hey, I bought some land, but I haven't seen it yet. I need to go out and take a look at it, so I can't come to your party. Please excuse me. Well, the second excuse is not much better. I bought some oxen. I need to go test them out. Think about this on our end. Perhaps you buy a car online. I don't know if you would do that or not. Usually, I think if you buy a car, you at least want to see it most of the time before you get it. This man's claiming, hey, I bought some oxen through word of mouth. I haven't actually seen them. I hope they're good, but I need to go test them out. Please excuse me. The third one, and I love this one. The man uses his wife as an excuse. Man, I don't know if you've ever done this before. My wife said I couldn't come. That's essentially what this man's saying. I just got married. My wife won't let me go. Now, in Deuteronomy 24, there is a law against a newly married man going to war his first year of marriage, but nothing about not going to a dinner party. In all likelihood, the wife might be like, yes, go. Good for you. You should go to this party. So all that makes the host a little upset, and rightly so. Everyone he's planned for and invited is backed out. They've accepted the invitation, but they've not lived up to their word. What's the host to do? He didn't call off the dinner. He's already prepared everything. There's no freezer to put the fatted calf in. No, it's got to be served. So this man, he sends his servant out to go invite the poor, invite the crippled, invite the blind and the lame, the unlikely members of society to be invited to such a great dinner. These are the ones who what? Society overlooks. These are the ones that society does not consider. But the host invites them. But even after inviting them, there's still room. So the host, he sends his servant out. He says, go even further than just your local area here. Go outside the town. Go to the highways and the hedges. Compel people to come to my banquet. And what about those who rejected the invitation? The host says, they're not welcome. They'll never taste my dinner. Now, we need to remember the context in which Jesus is telling this parable. Remember how he just healed the man with dropsy in verse 2 or verse 4? The man was used as a sort of prop or a tool to hijack this tenor from this ruler of the synagogue, from the Pharisees, in order to trap Jesus. They wanted to trap him in the act of healing on the Sabbath. Well, dropsy, as we said, was a disease where your body would not properly absorb liquid, and instead you would become swollen and bloated. Well, because of that condition, dropsy was often seen also as a consequence of gluttony. You become swollen due to the lifestyle that you've lived. meaning that you cannot resist the temptation to obtain more and more and more until your body can no longer handle it, especially since those with dropsy could never quench their thirst. So on a spiritual level, those with dropsy represented or symbolized those who could never quench their thirst in this world. So really, who's the one who has dropsy here in this situation? It is those who are making all the excuses for not being able to attend the dinner in this parable. But in the setting here, it is those who are also trying to trap Jesus, meaning that instead of hijacking the dinner on Jesus, they've hijacked themselves away from the kingdom. For their desires have swollen and bloated their hearts, so much so that they are not in need of physical healing, but spiritual healing. And the dinner that they will miss, it's not one of theirs, but it's the end time dinner of Revelation 19, the marriage supper of the Lamb. And to this, God is calling people from every background, from every nation in the world, and all who will accept will be at this great banquet, feasting forever and ever. Again, if you're here today and you're not a Christian, this invitation is extended to you. Whatever your background is, whatever you've done in the past, whoever you are, Jesus Christ has come to cover your past and to prepare you for a future with him. Accept the invitation and join with many of us in here, the invitation to this eternal banquet. And once that invitation has been accepted, what a call we have then to invite others to come with us as we with Jesus seek men and women from our neighborhoods, from our civic clubs, from our state, our nation, perhaps our one to join into this eternal banquet that has been prepared for all who will come. And we spend our lives looking towards this great day, looking towards the heavenly dinner, not what tomorrow may bring. So we pursue humility before God and others. This hijacked dinner is about much more than a healing that occurs on a Sabbath. No, it's about finding your heart right, being prepared for a greater dinner in an eternal kingdom with Jesus himself. Let's pray.